Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It is the 100th episode spectacular on the Council of Trent podcast. I am your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn, and I am so glad you dropped in today. Whether this is your first episode or your 100th episode, I wish there was a way I could track this. For those of you who I know there are faithful listeners out there who have listened to all previous 100 episodes of the podcast, I am grateful to you for your prayers, your support. I know that some of you are also premium subscribers at TrenthornPodcast.com. You make the podcast possible. You are the ones who brought us to 100 episodes and will keep us going. My goal, I want to have a spectacular times 10. I don't know why I have to have an accent in there, but whatever, for the 1,000th episode. And at the rate we're going, if we can keep up a daily or near daily podcast, we may be there, you know, within a few years. And I think that will benefit a lot of people to help them learn how to explain and defend their Catholic faith and give people the straight scoop on Catholicism, on the church, on our faith when it ends up in the news. I was tempted, dear listeners, I was very tempted today to want to ditch the 100th episode to talk about the March for Life and the debacle involving the media and other individuals who were blaming the Covington Catholic High School students who were at the March for Life, slandering them, maligning them. It was just a travesty. And if you follow me on social media, and you see, I normally don't get too worked up on social media. I'm not somebody who's posting every single hour on something. That's not what I do, because I like to be in the real world, not the virtual world as much. But this, I couldn't pass it up. So I on Twitter and Facebook, I was sharing a lot of videos, responding to all different kinds of people, including a Catholic priest who refuses and will dig in his heels still to apologize for his slanderous comments towards these teens. And I have a soft spot here for this, because as someone who's pro-life, who remembers being young, going to his very first March for Life and being energized, I've gone all around the country. I've spoken to thousands of high school students like these, and I always encourage them to want to stand up for life. But I hate the idea that some teens may be afraid to do that because they're worried that people are going to call them bigots because of an out-of-context video of them. I'll talk about this more on tomorrow's show. And then other quote-unquote Catholics throw them under the bus in order to appease the altar of secular liberalism. It really grinds my gears, you know, that we have to appease mainstream media and, you know, we have to be, I hate this idea of being overly apologetic about things. I hate when people rush to judgment about things. I've tried very hard. And when I don't do this, I'm human, I'm fallible, I'm willing to apologize for that, and I've done that before in previous media contexts. But I hate when people just, in the social media age, like, I gotta quick get out there and get my opinion out there. Well, your opinion might be wrong. Your opinion might be misguided. Why don't you keep your opinion to yourself until you know that it's worthwhile to share because it's true, good, and beautiful? Yeah. So you're like, wow, Trent's really worked up today. Usually he doesn't get like this. Well, yeah, I just have an emotional connection towards, because being pro-life is how I started being involved in apologetics. I was a pro-life apologist before I was a Catholic apologist, and I still have a soft spot for helping to mentor young people, high schoolers, and I want them to know that if they go out and defend life, I'm not going to defend everything they do. Like, if these students in this video had legitimately said something racist or did something racist, I would condemn that. But I want them to know we've got their back, because in this world, if you go out there to be pro-life, if you go out there to share your faith, people will attack you. They will lie about you. They will, as my old mentor, John, used to tell me, Trent, the pro-aborts will lie through their teeth to get you. If they don't care about killing babies, they won't care about lying. That is the truth. And that's what we have to deal with. Now, it doesn't mean we have to become cynical or fight evil with evil. St. Paul says, do not fight evil with evil, but do not conquer evil with evil, but conquer evil with what is good. And that is what we should do. I got that all out of my system. It's out there. I'll probably talk about it. If you listen to Monday's show, I'm doing a pro-life show on Catholic Answers Live. I'm sure I'll bring it up there. I'm going to do a full show on this tomorrow to draw out the themes and bring everyone in. But I had to get out of my system just because I've been obsessed with it on Sunday, seeing what was happening. But let us get now to the 100th anniversary show. 2 weeks ago, I put out a request at TrenthornPodcast.com for people to ask me for this show to celebrate 100 episodes of the Council of Trent, to ask me whatever questions they have. Any question you want about me, it's fair game. I'm happy to answer. And we got a lot of great questions, so I am happy to go through them now. And I'm grateful for our subscribers. Once again, these are the ones near, I think, basically everybody who is writing on Patreon. These are people who support the show or think of supporting it. So do go to trendhornpodcast.com if you would like to support the work we do here. All right, now on to the questions. Question number one. Were you more nervous before your debate against James White than against others? Surely you knew his history of slick arguments and debating tricks that can be hard to overcome on stage, and he's no neophyte when it comes to debates. Oh, that's true, yeah. James White has been doing debates. I've studied previous debates of his that took place probably when I was a toddler, honestly, and I think James made light of that a little bit when we met. We had dinner, with his associate, Frank Pierce. Who's the guy who works with him? Rich Pierce, I think. I think that's his name. Well, James, I hope I got the name of your associate right, but that was 2 years ago. You know, and John Sorensen, my colleague, was there, and we all had dinner the night before, and it was actually pleasant. We had a really pleasant conversation. We talked about Mormonism, and we were really talking about apologetics, and I felt like we were, you know, on the same page of a lot of things about the art of apologetics, especially against anti-Christian movements. But then in the debate itself, of course, the gloves come off or the gloves come on because it's like a boxing match. I don't know. And we went at it, but I thought it was actually a very civil debate. But was I nervous? Well, before any debate, any speaking event, I always have a little bit of pins and needles in me. If you don't have that, you're going to be reckless up there. You need to have a little bit of pins and needles in your stomach when you go out and do a public speech or a debate because it keeps you on your toes and it keeps you focused. Now, more so than other debates, yeah, definitely. I had a little bit more of that because, you know, it's like you're going in the ring with a heavyweight who's been around the block a few times, not just somebody, the local philosophy professor who's doing their very first debate. I mean, it's just like doing any other kind of sporting event or a boxing match. You know, I've done about 12 debates so far, and it really took me 3 to even figure out what the heck I'm doing. And it wasn't until like my 10th debate that I'm like, okay, I think I got a good feel for debates now. It takes time. It's a steep learning curve. So getting in the ring there, when I go up against, so if I have 12 debates under my belt, I debate someone who's done 1 or 2, I don't feel as nervous. If I debate someone like Dan Barker or James White, who has done 100 debates, you know, they've got it under their fingers. But what also happens to people who do lots and lots of debates is they can kind of be ingrained in their habits and they can become predictable. And I think with White and Barker, I was able to exploit that to be able to show where their arguments had serious weaknesses. So that's why I think the James White debate went well. And I'd be interested in debating him again. Honestly, I haven't been reached out on that. As I said before, of my debates, I usually don't reach out for them. I wait for people to come to me. But I'm open to that, which brings me to my second question, our second question for today's show. Another subscriber asks, I would like to hear more about your debates. Like, which one was the hardest? Are there any debates you're hoping to have in the future? Another questioner writes, what talks or debates do you want to do in the future? We do have one debate where in the preliminary stage of planning, that would be a team debate. I and another Catholic would debate 2 other Catholics. It'd be an intramural Catholic debate on the question of young earth creationism. So I got to actually talk to Chris Check to make sure it's still on. I would love to do this because I don't like the idea that someone thinks, well, I can only be Catholic if I believe the earth is less than 6,000 years old, because if they get an education in the sciences or even just a generally accepted knowledge of the age of the universe and the age of the earth, they may think, well, science has proven the earth is billions of years old, so I guess I got to give up my faith. No, not at all. Not at all. So we may do this debate on young earth creationism next fall. I'm looking forward to that. Other future debates? Well, people have proposed different debaters to me. I'd love to get on stage with Matt Dillahunty, either in a debate or a conversation, because he's very influential among atheists. They're the new atheists like Dawkins and Harris. Then there are the new atheists who are really more famous on YouTube than for any books they've written. And Matt Dillahunty is one of them. Anyone who's influential in promoting a worldview that's contrary to the Catholic faith, I would be interested in debating. Also those who promote teachings that are ambiguous, that can lead others into error. I would be interested in having a public conversation or a debate. When it comes to the church's teaching on homosexuality, for example, and how we should articulate that, I would love to be on stage with Father James Martin to be able to talk with him about what language should the catechism use? What should we believe about the morality of homosexual acts? And to talk about it and have it on the record what each person's position is and to be able to cross-examine and show each other's positions, which are faulty and which have the truth. So if you want me to debate someone, get a hold of them, contact Catholic Answers and say, hey, we'd like to organize a debate, get your local church, university. I'll tell you this. I have universities come to me all the time, student groups saying, we want to do an event. We'd love to bring a lot of people out to hear about abortion or the existence of God, whatever it may be. And in my experience, debates bring out so many people on campus. You do a talk, you're going to get 20 people there. You do a debate, you'll get 200, 500. When we did the debate at Minnesota State University, the room held 350 people, and then they were turning away people at the door. 150 of them went to an overflow room to watch it on television. So I think debates are a great thing in that regard. And in fact, next week, I'm going to be doing a podcast episode. I was interviewed for the Classical Theism podcast on the subject of how to defend the faith in debates. So if you like that subject, do tune in next week when I'll be airing that episode. All right, let's move on. I got an easy one for you. Do you speak a language other than English? Is there a language or languages out there that have interested you? See, I told you it'd be an easy one. Do I speak another language? Well, let me tell you this. Voy a la biblioteca. La casa es roja. I speak Spanish 1. When I was in Arizona State University, I studied ancient Greek as my foreign language. I did about 3 semesters of that. But then I had a problem. My schedule was overloaded, so I couldn't take Greek 4, and I needed to graduate ASAP. So over the summer, I tested into Spanish 201 and did Spanish 201 and 202, because you had to do 4 semesters of a foreign language for the graduation requirements at ASU. So I am not fluent in a foreign language. Like when it comes to Spanish, I can have a conversation, definitely, as long as it is in the present tense, about things that I do, not necessarily things I have done, will do, or am doing. But if you want to talk about things I do or stuff that I see in a room, I'd be happy to talk about that in Spanish with you. But otherwise, when it comes to languages important for the faith, I would say that I have a proficiency in ancient Greek and Koine Greek, though I also understand a bit about the grammar in Attic Greek that was spoken 500 years before Jesus was born, because that's the kind of Greek that I learned in my undergrad. So I have a proficiency in it. I don't have a mastery of it. I mean, there's people who are, you know, Greek scholars, Greek grammarians. I would love to be anywhere near that kind of a level. Languages in the future I'd like to learn more about. I'd like to grow deeper in my knowledge of Hebrew. I know much more Greek than I do Hebrew. I'd love to grow in Hebrew and also to learn about Arabic, because I'm hoping to do a book in the future on Islam. But I would not, honestly, I would not write a book on Islam, on, you know, the Quran, on that faith without being able to understand Arabic. I would just be so handicapped and not be able to really truly understand it, because the Quran, Islam is based on the assumption that the Quran is the word of God in Arabic. Like Muslims believe that if it's translated, it's not the most authentic version of the word of God. They'll say, well, if you criticize the Quran, that's because you're not reading it in Arabic. So I got to be able to do that as well. You got to be able to do that. So Arabic might be one. I might work on maybe the next 5 or 10 years, Semitic languages like Hebrew, Arabic. Plus also when you work on them, you really show your chops and you know how to pronounce everything right. And I love the pronunciations in Semitic languages, because I'm Semitic myself, so maybe I have a natural knack for it. So like the underworld, in, you know, when you read about it in Hebrew and Greek, it's Hades. In Hebrew, a lot of people say Sheol. Hey, you heard about that? Sheol? It's not Sheol is the underworld. It's Sheol. Sheol. So I love the pronunciation. So hopefully I work on that in the next few years. Next question. Do you ever get discouraged when you think about all the things you want to know but haven't had the time to learn yet? Yes, every day. It's the apologist dilemma. The more you know, the more you realize you don't know, and you want to become a intellectual glutton. So I totally see where you're coming from. I'm a recent convert, and it seems like there's so much work to be done. Any advice? And the follow-up question is, what do you hope to learn about in the future? Well, ancient languages is one. I want to grow in that area. Latin would be another language I'd love to be able to learn more about. I want to carpe diem that sucker as soon as possible. I would say, look, don't be discouraged. That remember, we have time on our side. There's a lot to learn out there, but you don't want to be stuck in the mode of thinking, I'm not learning all of that right now, so I'm not learning anything. Everybody, St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Paul, anyone who's learned about the faith, learned about the knowledge of God, has done so one truth at a time. That's everybody. And we have to be humble and let God work through us one truth at a time, and to make mistakes and learn from those. Some of the most important lessons we learn are from learning incorrect things, and then from that, being able to grow and see the correct things and the truths that come from that. So I would say that you don't have to be a master. No one's calling you to be that. That's why a master of everything, nobody's that. But that's why when I try to teach people to do apologetics, I want to give them the tools. I love teaching people how to ask the right questions, because you can master that in a day, and then you're off being a great defender of the faith. And then as the months, the years, the decades go by, you'll grow more in the knowledge that you can supplement with the very basic question approach. That, as I often tell people in my talks, you don't need to have all the right answers. You just need to have the right questions. So I think it's great to start with an approach that doesn't require a lot of knowledge and then slowly add on to that knowledge. I mean, you'll make something grand and amazing to glorify God with your knowledge one little bit at a time. The greatest natural wonders in the world, the Grand Canyon, Carlsbad Caverns, when you see these things, you see how they were carved and etched a little bit at a time. And that's how God works for us, and we have to be patient and let him do that. Next, is it stressful to do shows like Why Are You Atheist or Why Are You Pro-Choice, where you get some pretty aggressive and challenging callers? Tell us what it's like for you. Well, really, those shows for me, now that I've seen a pattern with them, especially when I do 2 hours of these shows. I pray beforehand so that I go, it's great, we have a chapel here at work, I can pray before the Blessed Sacrament to be able to be in the right mindset to engage these callers. And I still feel it. I mean, my posture is up, my shoulders might be broadened out a bit. I can feel my heart beating a little bit more, but I still feel in control of the situation because I'm the one asking the questions. I'm in the driver's seat of the conversation. And so sometimes though, when someone's very hectic, you know, I can slip into a debate mode more than a conversation mode. And I want to fire back very quickly because I do debates. I slip into that mode. But I'm always trying hard to regather myself when I'm doing this. Though I will tell you, on those 2 hour blocks, when I'm hour and a half in, my tank is running pretty empty. So prayers are always helpful. Then by the end, I'm pretty exhausted and wiped. But I think they're helpful. It's good for people to see that our faith can stand up to even very aggressive attacks against it. And we can share the truth without being aggressive in reply to these people. So not all the questions, though, are about the faith. I said you could ask me anything you want. And so we've got a few that are out there. I'd love to know who your favorite Power Ranger is and why. It can be any generation. I only remember the very first Power Rangers when I was a kid. I do remember that. I think actually Bryan Cranston from, Walter White from, I'm going to get in trouble now. No, I cannot be having a, it's not, you know the show I'm talking, Breaking Bad. Not that I had to Google or anything. I'm not a big Breaking Bad fan. Not that I'm not a fan, I never got into it, because I have small children. And also, when I watch TV, this is an insight between you and me, not a Walking Dead person, not a Breaking Bad person. I'm more of the Office person, Parks and Rec kind of person. At the end of the day, my work can be draining academically, intellectually, spiritually, emotionally. I just like stuff that's kind of light and fun. So the point is, going back, Bryan Cranston, who played Walter White in Breaking Bad, was one of the bad guys in an early episode of the Power Rangers, but he's in a suit. You can't tell that it's him. When I was a kid, probably the Red Ranger, because he's the coolest. Now that I'm older, my wife, when I told her about this, she laughed. She goes, what, the Pink Ranger? You love her. I have a minor celebrity crush on Amy Jo Johnson, the Pink Power Ranger. She's actually gone on to do a lot of other movies. She was in a great Canadian TV show called Flashpoint. My wife and I were obsessed with that show for a while. Like we would sit down. It's a Canadian drama about the special response, like a Canadian SWAT team going out to stop the bad guys. And they had great characters. And we were always like, they had this call sign when you had to shoot to take out the bad guy. We're always like, Scorpio, take him down. So if you want a great show to get into, I hope it's on Netflix. You can find it somewhere. I really enjoyed it. Flashpoint. I found it very addictive and an enjoyable show. Favorite Zelda game and thoughts on the Zelda series? I'm really sorry to have to do this. I'm not a big Zelda person. I played a ton of video games, SNES, when I was a kid. Never got into Zelda. So don't hang me for that one. I was a Super Mario guy. I was Super Mario and Donkey Kong. And Super Mario World is probably like my favorite. Well, Super Mario World and Star Fox, probably my favorite games on the Super Nintendo, with like Street Fighter coming up a close third. What book helped? Now let's go back now to more theological questions. What book helped you the most on your journey as an apologist? I'm currently in RCIA, and I'm always in discussions with family and friends who see my conversion as a good thing or at times a bad thing. When at the very beginning, three books were helpful to me becoming an apologist. One, just becoming Catholic, were Kreeft and Ticelli's Handbook of Christian Apologetics. It was just a systematic way of answering objections. Now I think in my own work, I've expanded on areas that it's, you know, a summarized handbook. They couldn't go too deep in any one topic. But I loved seeing these systematic answers. That inspired me to want to come up with answers of my own. Carl Keating's Catholicism and Fundamentalism was very important. Also, John Stackhouse wrote a book called Humble Apologetics. That book really helped me a lot. I don't agree with all the things Stackhouse teaches nowadays, but there were elements in that book about how our apologetics needs to be humble. It's sometimes when we come off saying like, oh, we're right, and you know, we're so overly confident and we lose nuance and important things, people don't take us as seriously. So I've tried hard in my own apologetics to be nuanced, to not be overly confident. I'm fine being confident, but I don't want to be brash. I want to be able to understand the complexity of the issues I'm talking about. And I want to teach others to be able to do the same, because people really appreciate that when we can say, well, there is this and this related to this issue. But if you look at the overarching thing, when we can do that, it shows people we've done our homework and they can trust what we have to say. What are your two most memorable moments as an apologist, both best and worst, the worst? This is a hard one to pick because I've had a lot of, you know, great moments and moments I'm like, I'd probably do that a lot differently. And when I get to the 1,000th episode, who knows? I might even have a gigantic gaffe worse than what's come up so far. Two come out in my mind. One, I remember in a debate with Cecily Chadwick, I misspoke about the issue of contraception and abortion. And what I said could be taken to mean that I didn't see anything wrong with contraception, which is not the case at all. What I meant was I don't see anything wrong with planning one's family, which is fine, using things like natural family planning. But I hate that I misspoke in that debate because it still follows me around and I have to correct it when people bring that up. And I was trying to just seem to people, I was really trying hard to win over those who are on the other side. And so now I've learned it's not worth speaking in ambiguities. But I've come to accept also when you do this line of work, you're going to make mistakes, you're going to misspeak. If you don't want to, if you're so worried about misspeaking, you can't speak at all. But then you're never going to get anything done. You're not going to be able to glorify God and do the work he wants you to do. I remember another moment I flipped out kind of on my family and my in-laws. I was just upset and throwing a temper tantrum when I read my very first article in Catholic Answers magazine that a fact I had written in there was wrong, or I think it was edited incorrectly to be wrong. And I thought, oh no, no one's going to take me seriously. Oh no. I'm like, well, you know, people are allowed to make addendums. They're allowed to correct themselves. And now I've learned, hey, I'm human. I want to get out there. I want to spread the truth. Usually I get it right. Sometimes I'm going to get it wrong. And that's okay. It's okay to make mistakes. It's just not okay to be stubborn and refuse to learn from them. Best moments, though, really, I don't have a single best moment, but anytime I get an email from someone that blesses me saying that the Holy Spirit used my work to help them come back to the faith or become Catholic, makes my day. I love hearing about that, not for my own ego, but to know it's not in vain that God is choosing to use this work. And your prayers, you who are listening, it helps me to be able to continue to do this work that benefits so many other people. Who would you want to interview on your podcast? Any dream guests? I would love to interview people that I could just have a great chat with. I love when I can sit down with someone. That's why, especially here at the Catholic Answers office, I love sitting down with my colleagues, you know, with Carlo, with Tim Staples, with Jimmy Akin. When I can sit down with someone, it's just us, and we can talk about an issue, and we're at the same intellectual speed, we can be running full-octane engines. It's just so much fun. Because, you know, when I'm on air and I'm talking about something, I usually have to summarize it or present it to a level for a lay audience who's never heard of it. But then if I want to talk to Jimmy Akin about philosophy related to actual infinities, you know, or Tim Staples about the use of specific use of Latin terms in the catechism, I don't have to do that. I can just run full steam ahead, all engines blaring, and just have fun with it. And of course, I love explaining things to people on air in the podcast. I'm happy to do that. But you can understand it's fun, like, you know, if you're doing an athlete or you're a fighter and you're sparring, you get in the ring or you're running the race with someone at your level or much higher, it just makes for a fun time. So I'd love to have people like Ed Fazer, William Lane Craig, you know, be able to kind of geek out. That's what it is. I want to be able to theologically geek out with someone. Or I'd love to sit down with Ben Shapiro. I know, you know, I on Twitter trying to get people to help me get on his show. Maybe one day I'll be recognized big enough. He will have me on a Sunday special. I'd love to have him on my show, mostly because he and I think we're really similar. I listen to his show. I don't agree with everything he says, obviously. But the way we approach issues, it is just so funny how he'll come up with an idea and I independently will come up with an idea for my podcast. We'll approach it a similar way. And then every now and then I beat him to the punch. He'd be really fun. And of course, we all talked to him about the relationship between Catholicism and Judaism. I actually just finished, my chapter on the Jewish view of Jesus called Jesus, the Rabbi Yeshua. So it'd be a lot of fun. So, you know, maybe one day. Let's see here. We have a lot of other questions. I might only have time for a few more. And then the other questions I am going to save for a bonus episode this week on the Council of Trent podcast. I know I have other bonus content I need to give you guys. The videos, working on them. I'm going to be straight up with you and honest because you're my friends. I have been sacked finishing my book, Counterfeit Christs. It's like that student who put off his paper. I mean, I didn't put it off. I had the book near done. But then I went back to it and looked at it. It was like, wait, I need to fix this. Wait, I need to fix that. Wait, I got to go to this other source and read through this. Oh, I got to add this in here too. I always, when I write books at the end, I completely tear down the walls and rebuild other stuff. So I have been sacked with that, with school. And so I've neglected my duty to give you this bonus content you deserve, especially those of you who are the premium subscribers. I'm very grateful for that. So just do be patient with me, dear listeners. I'm basically done with the book. The final manuscript, I'm getting it Todd tomorrow. Little tiny tweaks here and there. And then, of course, the laborious editing process will begin shortly. So do be patient with me, and I will get you that bonus content so very soon. Because in the meantime, I'm creating content I think is going to benefit you. This book on Jesus, it's kind of funny. Whenever I write a book, and I think Wednesday I'm going to do a podcast on writing. Whenever I write a book, I always go through the same phase. I start with excitement, and then I build, and I'm writing, and I'm like, this is great, okay. Then I hit the tough patches, and then it's like, oh, there's still a lot of work to do here. Then it feels like this book's never going to end. Then it's just like, oh, man, what am I doing? Oh, I can't look at this anymore. And then in the very end, you're like, wait, this is good. Let me add this and this. Hey, this is a lot better than I thought it would be. All right, I'm excited to send this off. That is the cycle whenever I write a book. I got to look it up here right now. Winston Churchill did a quote on writing books. Oh, let's see. Well, I'm the guy who wrote the book, of course, on fake saint quotes. So I don't know if Winston Churchill really said this. But whoever said it, I think they're right. This is what a Winston Churchill allegedly said about writing a book. Writing a book is an adventure. To begin with, it is a toy and an amusement. Then it becomes a mistress. Then it becomes a master. Then it becomes a tyrant. The last phase is that just as you are about to be reconciled to your servitude, you kill the monster and fling him to the public. Even if he didn't say it, I think that's a great quote. So now someone's going to send me a copy of the book, What Winston Churchill Never Said. Maybe I have an intrepid British listener of the podcast that will write his own book on what Winston Churchill and C.S. Lewis or what the great sayings the great Brits never said. That was actually, I'm sorry. I know he's going to rip into me. I am terrible at a British accent. You know, the only ones I can do ones that are related to British accents, like the Beatles, the Liverpool accents, the Beatles. Whenever I do an accent, I always have something like, it's a calibrating phrase, you know, so anytime I do something. So like for Scottish, it's McDonald's. I'm going to go off to McDonald's for my Scottish accent. I should just do a show on accents maybe in the future. So, all right, one more question, then the rest will be available as a bonus episode this week on the Council of Trent podcast. Tomorrow, I'm going to do a show on the Covington students, my thoughts on the March for Life, why it's important, why we should be marching for life. So, dear friends, I will address that, but I didn't want to put off or spoil our 100th episode together. So, last question, who's your favorite saint? I don't really have a favorite. You know, it's like the saints are people. They're our brothers and sisters in Christ. I don't have a favorite brother or sister. I don't have a favorite person in the world. My favorite person is Jesus Christ, even among my family, my wife, my children. There is no one single person who is my favorite. But there are saints I do resonate with a lot. And really, the one who I resonate with the most is probably St. Paul, convert, someone who's critical of the faith, then became a part of it, was willing to go out in public to debate, to evangelize, to write. That's why I chose Paul as my confirmation name. I remember when I chose that, actually, I was going there to be confirmed, you know, for Easter Vigil. I got the name tag. He says, Paul, those are big shoes to fill. Indeed they are. And you know, I'm grateful for the little bit of grace God has given me to do the little bit of evangelism that helps us out in our world, to be able to share the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the good news about the church he founded. There's the pillar and foundation of truth. And any little bit that I can do with his grace to build that up, I am happy to do to serve him, whatever the cost may be. And I'm grateful for you, for your prayers that allow me to do that. So I hope you will continue to support the Council of Trent podcast, 100 episodes down. Let's get another 100 under our belt. Let's make our way to 1,000 in a few years with your support. Thank you guys so much, and I hope you have a blessed day.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.